There are two schools of thought concerning the phrase dancing about architecture. The predominant school dismisses it as a foolish statement that has no reasonable place in the English language. I mean, how can one dance about architecture? It's just not done. It's a bit like raising a glass to toast an umbrella. Human moments are best confined to humans rather than silly constructs which often last longer than your average lifespan. And then there is the other, more interesting and more challenging school of thought. Dancing about architecture? Well, of course. I mean, it's just one of the many components of life. We should dance about everything, dammit. Films, books, art, culture, music, empty containers and waste paper baskets, bags of rice, yesterday's newspaper that you haven't even read, Jell-O, Legos, Egos, humorless politicians, and of course, architecture. I bring this up because while reading Edie Madoff's novel, Crawl Space, I got the sense of a book that did its damnedest to throw a monkey wrench into these austere sentiments we somehow cling to in the 21st century. Why should we give credence to an insufferable Nazi as protagonist? To a man who has the temerity to go back to the very village where he, while serving as prefect, sent many Jews to their deaths? Life, of course, is hardly black and white, and it was with these shades of gray sputtering about in our noggins that LBC member Scott Esposito and myself met up with Madoff in a Berkeley cafe to discuss some of these things and more. But before all this, I talked with our girl in Chicago herself, who nominated this book for the Lit Blog Co-op, and explained to me how this book spoke to her. So I am here with our girl in Chicago of About Last Night, who is the nominator for Edie Madoff's Crawl Space. Our girl, or Laura, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Ed?
I'm doing all right. So tell me, why did you select Crawl Space? What was it about the book that spoke to you?
Well, a couple of things. One general and one specific. First of all, I'm somebody who never did that great with history in school, and over the years I've realized that my favorite way to get my history is really through novels. So I think there's a lot of that in Crawl Space, a really detailed view of World War II, occupation France, and what went on there. And, you know, this is my really favorite way to get my history. And along those lines, around the time I had to make the nomination, I went to see Jean-Pierre Melville's Army of Shadows. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. I'm a big Melville fan, so.
Yeah, it came out in the spring. It was its first release in the U.S., even though it was made in something like 1970.
Yeah.
And it kind of gives the other side of the story that Crawl Space tells, which is, you know, it's an inside look at the French Resistance. And that was heavy on my mind, and I had read Crawl Space, and was thinking of them as a kind of interesting, you know, set of companion pieces. And so it resulted in my nominating Crawl Space.
Oh, okay. Was the anti-hero sort of... it's a very particular perspective. Was this one of the sort of things that kind of spoke to you, or?
Well, it was definitely, it was fascinating. I think it's something that sounds like it might be something you don't want to hear, but then almost immediately, I think Edie Madoff's novel draws you in because it's so beautifully crafted, and the character, as she's imagined it, is completely fascinating. So I think there's something about the unlikeliness, you know, of the story.
Yes, indeed. Well, our girl, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you.
Okay, so I am here with the LBC nominee, Edie Madoff, who is the author of Crawl Space. I'm also here with some guy named Scott Esposito, and this is actually, I think you're the first person to actually appear three times on the Bat Segunda
show.
Wow, you know?
So I guess Volman and David Mitchell really got something to shoot for now. Could get that third appearance.
They'll get that third appearance in a couple of years, I guess. But anyway, Wow. But more importantly than you, we've got Edie Madoff. So Edie, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Okay. First off, I wanted to sort of head and maybe kind of discuss how you came to come up with this anti-hero character, Emile. Maybe what was it about, you know, sort of portraying a Nazi that kind of, you know, piqued your interest? Depicting a Nazi, rather. Not portraying a Nazi because you weren't on stage. So.
Sure. So, you know, the origin for the novel, one origin for it was that I was thinking about how in my own psyche, I've told this to Scott in a separate conversation, but I notice that I will tend to return to a site of guilt if I feel guilty. You know, there's your website, Return of the Repressed. So I totally I've noticed that about myself. So thinking also, my father was born in Poland. All my extended family was exterminated in World War II. And I wanted to approach the Holocaust tangentially. And I've always been this sort of garden variety Francophile. And I thought, okay, I was teaching at the New School for Social Research in New York. And I went through this photo exhibit. I saw these photos on the wall of all these sort of figures on straw mats in the deportation camps. And I thought, I just had cognitive dissonance given my love for the French. And so I went to France serendipitously, found a small town in the Pyrenees, and started living there and slowly got wrapped up in the life of this town. And at the same time, fortuitously, there was this trial of this escaped war criminal, Maurice Papon. I went to the trial in Paris. He had escaped his trial. All the French journalists were gossiping. And I thought, I'm going to... Well, this character started to take over the novel, as novelists tend to say, disingenuously. But this is actually the case. You know, this voice kind of cannibalized everybody else's voice.
Sure.
Originally, it had been a novel about a man coming to France to talk about a filmmaker talking about the legacy of his refugee father, and then it slowly became Emile's story.
Huh, huh. Was the mother-daughter attorney team inspired from this trial? I'm just curious about that.
It departs from some really famous Nazi hunters in France who are not female.
Okay.
A father-son team.
And also, Scott, I would encourage you to ask questions, too. This is a kind of tag team. It's a conversation, not an interview.
I thought I was just sitting here to observe the two of you, but now I understand my role better.
And to hear me echo things I said to you.
Jump right in here, Scott.
Once I have something to say, I will waste no time.
Okay. Well, okay, then. I guess I'll continue here. I thought you'd be a co-interviewer, like conversational. That was the whole idea here. But okay.
I repeat, once I have something to say, I will waste no time.
Okay. Anyway, the character names. You have Polquet, which is like drumstick, and you also have Ariane, which is very close to Aryan. I was wondering if that was an intentional sort of, cognitive sort of, situation, or maybe you could describe how these character names came about.
Well, I like to start with jokes in a lot of, when I'm choosing a character's name often, and so in Yiddish, polka means a chicken leg,
yes.
And there's a point in the novel where that's discussed,
yes.
So I wanted the name Polke, mm-hmm. based on that, because of his fear, and Ariane, there's a Sanskrit belief that when you have phonemes that are ah, it opens the heart.
Mm.
So I wanted a name that kind of opened the heart, closed it, and opened it again.
Really? Because I was thinking it was like sort of a wry kind of play on Aryan.
Aryan.
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting. I love hearing what people hear from things.
Okay, okay. Well, the tone of this book of Emile's story is very similar, I think, to Humbert, actually. And I was wondering if Nabokov was possibly an inspiration of this, or what steps did you take to, we could talk about the style later, but I kind of want to get a sense of, what steps you took as a writer to kind of get everything sort of fixated on, this guy's story, on making him not just a despicable Nazi, but a very sort of interesting character.
That's a wonderful question. In this very cafe, I remember as a teenager reading Lolita. So,
really?
Yeah, I remember. It's interesting somehow you say that. It wasn't a conscious choice. I was saying to Scott the other day that, I think in this era of sort of split attention span, ADD consciousness, or whatever you want to call it, we're such a fractured society that to have a first person confessional is sometimes the way that we believe information is the most authentic. So I often play with voices when I'm coming up with a novel, but you know, it seemed right to have it come emerge from within his consciousness, to have it be this direct self-vindication. If it resembles Humbert Humbert, I love that. What an honor. Or if it has any even distant familial relation. Gotcha. But that wasn't conscious.
Okay. Now, there's also some interesting sort of stylistic choices. Like, for example, you have Jews in Israel in lowercase letters for the first letter. I was wondering if there are any other sort of stylistic sort of ticks that you were consciously going for that helped you kind of channel this character, perhaps.
There were certain, you know, just as German has its own sentence structure, in France, in French, there's certain kinds of ways of loading on adjectives that when one is highly emotive. Mm-hmm. And so there were certain times that I tried to hold my hand back from doing it too much, but I would do it a little bit. So I would sometimes layer a certain kind of adjective into a sentence.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other interesting thing is because this is sort of hypothetically a French going to English, or, you know, I mean, is this a translation or is this, you know, actually written in English? You know, that's the other question that people have. I mean, was this kind of a conscious thing you were thinking of when you were writing this? Or?
It's written in English.
Yeah.
And yet every now and then I wanted to reference some quality of French.
Scott, do you have any questions here?
Well, I was thinking back to what you were saying about Emile going through his personal history. I'm reading a book right now called Moore, and it has a number of photographs in it. It's about this guy, Max Moore, who is a German author. He's also a Jew. And anyway, the photographs form an interesting counterpoint to what is actually he's remembering from his past. And so I guess I was wondering if there's anything in your book do you think kind of forms a counterpoint or maybe a reference point, you know, that kind of can give us a second sense of what Emile is telling us about himself, because it's all from his perspective.
Mm-hmm, that's a good question. Okay, so the question is sort of how does one, or how did I try to impart a multidimensionality beyond the hermeticism of his own
self? Yeah, yeah, like some kind of reference point that's not him, which admittedly is hard because it is all from his perspective.
I think I was hoping that the character of Izzy would give a multidimensionality. You know, Izzy's, you know, there's one scene where Emile is viewing Izzy in this cafe, and Izzy's his childhood friend whom he's betrayed. And he sees Izzy as this noble figure, but he's like, you know, he's seeing him as a despicably noble figure. And I just wanted the reader to experience a certain vertigo in, the, you know, a certain multidimensionality of character using, you know, ordinarily we would say, oh, victim equals nobility. You know, and so that was my hope. Izzy was really a conscious contrapuntal element. Yeah.
There's also one, I mean, this kind of ties into Scott's question a little bit, and that is, you know, the whole you can't go home again sort of motif of Finier, or Finier, however you say it. French I suck at, so. But the interesting thing, though, is that you kind of surround him and kind of submerge him into sort of like, you know, what 1999 France is, as opposed to kind of, you know, traces or remnants of like, you know, what he experienced during the occupation. And I was wondering, you know, was this kind of an issue you were wrestling with in terms of like, you know, because he does obviously explore his memories throughout the course of this book with various flashbacks. But the interesting thing to me was that in the present day, there is... it's almost as if there's very few indicators. He falls in with these groups of kids and these drug addicts and the like, which is a very interesting sort of decision. Maybe you can talk about any sort of struggles you made in terms of, like, you know, who is still living that he can talk with, aside from, of course, like, you know, this whole, you know, trial thing that he escapes at the beginning.
Okay, that's a good question. So this is going to sound kind of weirdly Californian or mystical, but... you know, there's sort of an absolute stillness in the center of every person, right? And so meaning comes when you rub one point of time against another point of time, or one person against another person, you know, or how we craft our social being by, you know, various, you know, tags or identifiers. So I was using the world of secondary characters as a means, as you're saying, of illuminating the paradoxes of his psyche.
Sure.
So the reason I chose the wastrels, who are these kind of anarchist teenager squatter people, whom I saw a lot of in France, and Scott also had talked about this at one point, is that what distressed me when I was living in France was this sort of rising anti-Muslim sentiment. This was in 1999 that I was living there, before so much occupied the center of our zeitgeist, this kind of consciousness about, you know, pro-anti-Muslim. And so I wanted to create a contemporary correlate to Pulque's time, and I wanted to have Pulque have to make choices that he hadn't made. So... does that answer your question?
Yeah, it sort of does.
I think in that way, the wastrels add a lot of dynamism to the novel, just kind of, you know, making it more about something that's going on in the present, but also just on the level of characters. I mean, I think that if it was just him at the town through 400 or 500 pages, I think that would have been a very long book.
It would have been a very kind of lonely, hermetic, more East European kind of, like, you know, Hampson novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could do that for a certain length, but you know, once you get too long in the head of that one character, it just becomes tedious. But with these other characters, interacting with them, I mean, when he comes upon Noah, Is that his name? The first one he meets.
Moses.
Moses. Noah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was kind of like it injected. I felt it injected a little bit of life. You know, it was just something coming from a completely different source. And, you know, and then the book started really kind of going in a different direction from there. So, I like the characters just for that reason.
Well, there's also the thing is, I think the characters in this book allow Emile to sort of bounce some of his, like, faux high culture stuff off, and I think that's also where a lot of the sense of play in this book actually comes from. Maybe you can describe, like, you know, how much the characters served as kind of, like, you know, thing, you know, devices for Emile to sort of ping pong some of his attitudes or his feelings off of, or you know, or how did they kind of come into being? Did you, I mean, the sense I got when I was reading this was like the secondary characters kind of just sort of sprung to life, and it almost seemed like it came from this kind of impetus, this whole, we can't have a sort of drifter going on for 400 pages. We have to have something to kind of at least allow for a comparative indicator for his feelings versus the remainder of humanity. So maybe you can.
Okay, well, the truth is, I mean, I would love if I were so Apollonian in all my writing decisions, I was living up the northwestern coast in Gualala, which is near Mendocino, and I was writing in a storage shed, literally. And so all day long I saw people coming in and out with their belongings, looking harried. At the same time I was writing the story of Emile, and it was very kind of solipsistic story at that point. It was pretty early on. I went to this art opening, and there were some people who had come back from Burning Man. And they just entered the novel, and they were the wastrels. And I wasn't in France anymore. So that's really what happened.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. And I always believe if the author surprises him or herself, the reader will be surprised. So that it makes me happy to hear Scott say that it sort of took the novel in a new direction. I wanted them to be a breath of fresh air. And I was surprised as I was writing, okay, you know what? And then, you know, the meaning kind of is a fallout from that interaction.
Sure. You wrote this thing in a shed, though?
One part of it.
One part
I was
of it.
Pregnant, living up north.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What were you writing on? A paper typewriter?
Writing in the summer, for God's sakes. Yeah.
No, it's pretty cool up there.
Yeah, okay.
It's fog-bound, crazy coast.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm curious. I mean, this is, what possessed you? I mean, like, Rupert Thompson wrote his book in, like, one of his books in a Winnebago.
Oh, okay.
Or in a trailer of some kind.
I like seeing people in positions of extremity. You know, I like writing where I'm seeing weird human interactions. It really helps me. Hmm. You know, you live in the hate with a bay window onto, like, the crazy street. I mean, you must enjoy that.
Well, I mean, I do write, like, in a cafe because it's all sorts of demented people come in there. And interesting people.
Right.
I mean, I don't view all people as demented. What about a shed, though? That just seems a very idiosyncratic.
It was available, and I loved the weirdness. You know, I saw up there, you know, the main cash crop is sort of well, basically it's secretive drug dealers that I saw all day moving their belongings and looking around very nervously. It was very fascinating.
How much of, I mean, but we didn't get it from, you know, Scott was saying, you know, how much, what did, how did you write in the shed? Was it like a laptop typewriter
paper? Yeah. It was outfitted. Yeah,
oh,
I mean.
Okay, okay. And how much of crawl space was written in the shed?
You know, a good part of it. Okay. Yeah.
And right when you hit the wastrels, you decided to move out of the shed, or?
Yeah, it's that I struck gold. Now I can leave. No, we moved down here. I was becoming director of this new college MFA program, so okay. I came down here.
So speaking of sheds, that kind of has a resemblance to the title of the book, the crawl space, mm-hmm. kind of the shed space in between buildings. And I was a little curious about the title. I guess I kind of looked at it like the crawl space as being this place where this baggage accumulates kind of like in between eras and you kind of have to deal with the fallout. That was how I was reading it. I was just curious, you know, what did the titular crawl space mean to you, and you know, why did you make that your title and kind of place it in the middle as a metaphor?
You know, I love hearing the multiplicity of readings, and I hate dictating. I really believe in the reader response theory, you know, this kind of sense that every reader is bringing his or her own baggage. But for me, I wanted this guy cramped by levels of history above him, you know, in the wormy place close to death. Also, I learned the word when I was living up in Gualala, and I just loved it. We were living in this old mildewy house, and I thought a lot about crawl spaces, so it sort of entered that way.
I see. So you think at the end of his life, he's kind of boxed in by everything that's happened to him? I mean, you think that kind of curtails his agency?
I mean, it's close to a grave. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's how high can you stand in a crawl space? History. This guy saying history has defined the contours of his being.
Mm.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about, and let me see if I can find it. It's this interesting graph that you have, Emil make.
Oh, you mean the cross?
The cross graph, yeah. How did this come about? I'm just trying to find it here, but it was very, very interesting to me. It's like.
It's to describe agency. It had those two axes.
Internal circumstances.
And I think you even had him say that it was kind of his cross that he had been crucified on.
Yeah, here's some of the... What I chart by this is awareness. It is sometimes possible for an insult to occur because a person is unaware of one's sensitivity or presence. It was this type of insult, an external circumstance, my proximity to him, coupled with the American's complete unawareness of Emil Polquette's inner life, hence my experience of his brute otherness. I mean, and it goes on, and it's just like, it's this really interesting graph, and then as we listen to his explanation for it, it becomes more absurd, you know, in the sense that he's really sort of... It's such a very interesting device as an author to basically chart a graph and then realize that this is just another sort of way for him to kind of escape his own sort of personal obligation to deal with his past memories. How did you come across this graph and what for this? This is quite an elaborate sort of situation, more so than other authors. Maybe you can just talk about this and how the germination point for all this.
Okay. In 1988, I was standing in a train station in Bridgeport, Connecticut, waiting to be picked up for something, and I was aware that all the other riffraff in the train station, because I might have been dressed sloppily that day, I did this chart in my head that if one were drunk, anyway, it doesn't matter. I won't go into this whole thing, but it was like if one has a sloppy gait but neat dress, mm-hmm. I mean a neat sloppy dress and a neat gait, one would think that might be an American. Sloppy gait, sloppy dress, one might think a drunkard. You know, neat dress, sloppy gait, one might think Italian. I mean, I went into the... I was just, like, wasting time. So it was a sort of a second generation from that graph.
I mean, it also seems to be that, like, you know, cross graphs of this nature seem to be more... You seem to have possibly been prescient to some degree because, you know, like, the political compass graphs that's on the internet where you chart, like, where you are politically and, you know, there's Volman's moral compasses, of course, and, like, you know... There's a good deal of cross graphs that seem to have, particularly you know around 99, where I suppose it all originated. And I don't know if any sort of, you know, faux or genuine sort of statistics motivated this graph, or if it was just kind of like a.
Well, it's like that Myers-Briggs test, you know, with those four poles and.
it's true. You know, I grew up in, you know, Berkeley of the 70s and 80s, and there was a strong urge to quantify the qualitative all around me. You know, I would hear people say, you're a three, you're a six, you're an Aquarius, you're a this, you're, you know, I mean, all sort of, so I'm incredibly fascinated by those feeble feints we make toward quantifying the unquantifiable.
Well, it's not just limited to the graph. Frequently, you know, Emile makes like little sort of bullet points throughout the book. Was this kind of also kind of a natural extension of this? And why did the bullet point format, how did that appeal to you more so sometimes than just actually him expressing these kinds of emotional turmoil going on within?
I love texts that disrupt the reader's passage through the page. Mm-hmm. I love footnotes. I love Sebald's pictures.
Yes.
I love anything that creates a little bit of, I think it allows the words to enter in a new way. When I was in college, I was a painter for most of the time, and I just really believe in having a pictorial element on the page.
Okay.
So that helps me also.
Text-wise, do you look at that visually as well when you're writing something? Or, I mean, also, like, I know the other question is sort of semi-related to that is the, I noticed that the chapters kind of get progressively shorter as the book goes along, and whether what perhaps the intent of that is, and maybe we can tie this in with, I guess, the visual approach of a text. When I talked with T.C. Boyle, he was just, you know, he was totally obsessive about this notion of, like, how the page actually looked, and that this was as important to him as what it said, and maybe you can talk about these two ideas here.
Well, I know Don DeLillo once said that when he's typing, he has like a huge page. I mean, he makes his page huge, so he really sees. So I would do that if I had that luxury. I think it's a question of the arc of pacing. I think it's nice to have. Also, I think when you have a moment that's potentially melodramatic, better to say less. So as events are sort of speeding up and the noose is tightening around Emile, I like having kind of a more lucid, sparer writing style.
Gotcha. Okay. So did you sort of, you just designed this in the very beginning when you started?
No. I get lost in thousands of pages and I throw out three books to come up with any one book.
Really?
And it could have been many other books. I mean, it ended up being this book.
Oh, okay. Really? Yeah. Really? Well, what sort of... How did you pinpoint Emile's story above all other ones? What other stories did you actually sort of like, you know, throw into the dust heap when writing?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, okay, so I already mentioned the one about the male filmmaker coming to do something about his father who was a refugee. You know, there was another thing about the whole section about the female reporter, you know, a whole thing about Natalie. I mean, the people, you know, it's a question of proportionality. Mm-hmm. I have a great editor who is really patient and really like the old time brilliant editor who works with me.
That actually brings up another kind of curiosity I had, and that is, what is the FSG? Maybe you could tell us who the editor was, and what is it? How do they edit over at FSG? I've always been curious about that.
Okay, so, you know, with my first book, I had a lot of, I think every writer who's trying to get published, you know, I have a whole speech for them, but that's a separate little thing. But, you know, anyway, so there's a whole synchronicity. And he was at Houghton Mifflin, and he was an intern for the guy who became my agent, actually. No, he was, before he became. And then slowly he did very well at Houghton Mifflin, and he published Jonathan Safran Foer and other people. And then in the middle of that, he moved to FSG, Eric Chinsky. And he's now, I guess, now he told me he's like the chief editor at FSG or something. But so I've been with him two houses. He's just, I don't know. I don't know if there's anyone else like him. I just think he's really brilliant, philosophically trained, really, you know, smart about kind of the meta structure, the sort of macro ideas behind a book. And that's what I really respond to when I'm working with him.
Yeah. And he was, I guess, flexible to a writer who had like, hey, here's 3,000 pages that I'm not quite certain how it's going.
Well, or you know, it's like you see things in different mutations. And also my agent was like that too.
Okay.
Very patient. Yeah, they're used to me kind of throwing out crazy trees and then kind of responding.
Gotcha.
Well, of the characters you mentioned, the female reporter, the documentary filmmaker, Emile, it seems like Emile was the most interesting of them. Maybe it's just that, you know, if you had inhabited their space, we would have seen a lot more nuance in them. But it seems like things were more deeply felt with him. they seem to be a little more superficial in their approach. You know, he was the one that you would want to follow through a number of pages.
Sure. No, I do think there's a thing of finding the center of gravity, but it's, you know, I always think novel writing is like you're painting a mural, you're painting, doing incredible detail in an ear, but you don't know what the entire proportions are going to be. You don't have the master blueprint, but you have to proceed in good faith with that ear.
Yeah, it seems like just, you know, good writers have a sense of which characters to follow. I remember I talked to a writer named Ed Falco, and he writes short stories and novels. And so I asked him in an interview, what's the difference between this short story and this novel? Because they both kind of start from a similar premise. And he said with the novel, there are three characters that he knew he'd want to follow through. And with the short story, there's just one character who he kind of wants to draw. Oh, so it just seems like you got to have a good sense of which ones are going to really be fruitful for that length of, what, 200-300 pages.
Yeah. That's right. It's like the difference between a bus ride and a marriage or something, which you're sharing with somebody.
Well, how do you, to jump off of this question, how do you as a writer breathe life into a supporting character like Deli, who appears, who I found to be kind of interesting sort of wastrel near the end? What do you do to, make that character, is there sort of when you're dealing with like this sort of like compulsive first draft, for lack of a better word, or lack of a better adjective, what do you do to sort of make the balance of the characters, like, give the character enough vivacity and also, but not have it overwhelm your main character, like Emil in this case?
Well, it's such a good question. I feel like you answered the question, in your question. But, okay, so the challenge is always, how do you give enough contradictory aspects within any character, staying within the bounds of consistent character, yet not stretching credibility? With a secondary character, my feeling is you don't want to, you want to be surprised. You don't want a stock character.
Yeah.
You want somebody who, but yet you don't want them to steal the, I don't know. I don't have an absolute formula. It's more, I want to populate the little chessboard with characters who interest me and then have them surprise me when I'm writing. And I try to do, sometimes when I'm really in that generation, not revision stage, I try to do the kind of word quota per day thing to get past my superego and actually be surprised. Sometimes, because I'm a mom and I work, it's like I have a really limited time to write. And so that in some way that creates a nice situation for me where it comes in a real burst.
Gotcha.
So I'm a little interested by what you're saying about the word quota, get past the superego. So are you more of a writer where you put a lot on the page, you don't like take each word by word and agonize over it?
I always think there are the lapidary writers
The
Dionysian Dionysian versus the Apollonian. So I'm definitely Dionysian. So I have, like, right now I'm in that stage right now where I'm trying to stitch together some semblance of an arc with my current novel, but it's come from like really thousands of pages.
Well, see, that's interesting, because I mean you said before style is so important to you, and it's clearly reflected in what you write. You would think you'd be the kind of person who would agonize over each one.
But that's in the revision. That's a
pleasure. Yeah. Right,
then
right.
It's like I go through it. I steamroll through it like thousands of times after, once I finally get the arc. And then I can play with the words. And that's like, that's such a generous, that's like film for me. It's like film editing. It's like the medium is speaking to me and giving to me. And so there's a reciprocity, not just me ab ovo creating,
Well, there's such an amount of life, I think, in this book that when you come to the whole drowning my babies phase or whacking my kneecaps phase, are you now sort of like accomplished enough of a writer to sort of get beyond that particular drowning the babies phase, or does it still hurt when you drown your babies?
I had a friend in college who was a songwriter, and we would talk about this thing of like writing to the chorus, so like I just saw the Leonard Cohen movie I was telling you guys. So, Leonard Cohen writes to the chorus. So every time the word hallelujah appears in one chorus, it has a different valence, right? And so the songwriter friend of mine was saying, he was just saying, I just proceed in good faith, hoping that something good is going to appear down the road. In other words, never hoarding the babies, trusting that I'll have enough stamina to get up the hill, putting the best forward each time. So I kind of try to do that. I try not to hoard the babies and just like kill them off. And I actually even had a dead babies file for.
Did you really?
I did. Wow. Yeah, I'm not doing that for this book. I should. But yeah, that helped me because I would just be like, I just save them somewhere else so I wouldn't feel like I was losing those precious parts of prose.
Wow.
The, you know, to dead baby, I know this is kind of going to sound weird to people don't know that Faulkner quote.
Yeah,
right. Your darling.
It's yeah. Like your own personal crawl space, your dead baby's file.
There's actually a train that's taking these babies away.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. No, I'm just, yeah, sorry. Nazi thing. What was I going to say? I had a question and I totally forgot.
So with. I don't know, I mean, is there ever some temptation to kind of go back to the old material and try to mine it? I mean, you must have...
You have to go forward.
there must be a ton of ideas that, you know, you've not followed for one reason or another, but you never have a temptation to try to rewrite them.
I don't go back.
Do you feel it's that you're really being insistent with it? Is this something you feel is necessary? Is it important to you?
I don't know. It's some kind of weird ethos for me. It's about... trusting that, you know, I guess every artist in their, if you look at their biography, you know, like the thing, I was once at a table of poets at McDowell and they were complaining, oh, no poets really ever write anything really original after age 60. And they were all, you know, like I think 59 or I don't know how old they were. And they were all kind of mourning this. And, you know, I guess there will be a time when I want to go back and cannibalize the older work. Mm-hmm. Because I won't have the neural synapses firing at that hugely, you know, quick rate. But I don't know. For now, I just feel like just forge forward. Mm-hmm. Don't go back.
We're starting to run out of time. But I did want to actually ask you in terms of going back to this whole chessboard thing you were mentioning earlier. Are there tricks that you sort of set up, perhaps in the course of plotting this, maybe you can kind of elaborate upon this? I mean, you know, some writers need to constantly put themselves off guard so that they can actually get and exist in that whole problem-solving mode. Maybe you can describe, you know, what you do, you know, in terms of this chessboard, this hypothetical proverbial chessboard that you're talking about, to keep the sort of struggle of Emile alive and to keep the momentum going in crawl space and to go with that sort of, you know, this imaginary sort of line that we sort of described the narrative.
I like Ibsen's thing about introducing a loaded gun in the first act. Mm-hmm. I like setting up kind of counterpoint rules for myself, as you say, you know. All of these same sort of common sense, but, you know, speaking, if I'm speaking in a flowery diction, mm-hmm. you know, really getting into that. My father speaks a really florid immigrant's English. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Emile is a composite of many people I know and also is me. And so, but there, that thing of just kind of almost kinesthetically feeling one part of me activated as I'm writing a character within my body or within, you know, some part of me is cut off. You know, probably for Emile, I was cut off at the neck.
Well, Scott, did you have any final thoughts here?
Any final thoughts?
Or question here?
I don't have any final thoughts. I have
final solutions.
Do you have some emerging thoughts that aren't necessarily your final ones? You have plenty of thoughts throughout the rest of your life until you die. So I'm just offering your final thoughts is kind of a misnomer, I think.
My final thought is that the foregoing 30 seconds should be properly edited.
I'm keeping it in, damn it. Okay, well, I guess... that's it then. Well, E.D., Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to catch you both.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.